It's been a long week. We have covered everything from gun violence to the eternal debate of indoor versus outdoor cats. And so, as always, we have assembled a group of smart people to help us figure out what the heck happened this week. It is time for The Break Room.
Some things will be dealt with at a later date.
If at all.
I think it's time to ask whether Facebook may have moved too fast and broken too many things.
With me this week is Stephen Brown, chief film critic of SilverScreenCapture.com, and former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr. We've got Greg Williams, mortgage banker and host of the conservative radio podcast. It's called Greg's List. And we've got Anjali Njeti. She's an activist and vice president of membership for the National Book Critics Circle. Hello to you all.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. All right. So we were just listening to the music. This is Fleetwood Mac. They have fired guitarist Lindsey Buckingham. He played on a lot of their biggest hits like Go Your Own Way. All right, Greg, I want to start with you. What has been your most heartbreaking or misguided band shakeup or breakup? This is probably one of them.
Yeah, this is definitely top five, you know, Guns N' Roses breaking up. It was pretty traumatic. They're back now, but they, you know, when they kicked Axl out for a while, that was pretty rough. And Pink Floyd, right? Oh. When Roger Waters was let go and David Gilmour took the band in a different direction, it was, you know, missed all of the writing and the genius lyrical ability combined with David Gilmour's amazing solo skills. So that was, those are probably my top three band breakups.
What about you, Kathy?
I've got a couple. One is Athens' own REM, and they just stopped touring. It was sad. I mean, it was like they broke up. They just said, we're not doing it anymore. And also, you know, this is not a breakup, but the recent death of Tom Petty. Because I also love Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and that's very upsetting to me. He finished his anniversary tour, and that was it.
Yeah, what about you, Stephen?
Mine is REM as well. You know, it was two decades ago when Bill Berry decided to be a farmer instead of a drummer, and the whole band sort of had a little melancholy vibe there, made a few more albums, but it sort of went away. So as a Gen Xer who grew up on Van Halen having a rotating doors of a lead singer, REM was probably my most disappointing one.
What about you, Anjali?
So for me, it's definitely Guns N' Roses and REM. I mean, when you come of age, when these bands are big, it is like going through a divorce when a band breaks up. And I never got to see them in concert.
Oh,
so I was
sad.
Like, for me, why can't you stay together?
Make it work out.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. What is it about the band breakup that just does something to us?
Well, I was lucky last year. The wife is a huge fan of Guns N' Roses. So when they got back together, we went. The concert was at the Dome. It's one of the final Dome concerts. But we paid us $120. And you felt like you had been to a rock concert. We went to Bon Jovi the next year. And Bon Jovi was like cheese and wine compared to Guns N' Roses. Like, you know, I thought we were at Chastain, for God's sake, you know.
Oh, well, that tells back. You, though.
Yeah, yeah. They are. Well, they're going to tour forever, I think.
Yeah, yeah, Bon Jovi. Okay. All right. So what about you? How do you feel about, what is it that does something to you about these breakups?
You know, you do look for lightning striking in a bottle with bands, and you sort of hope as they grow and mature, make that sophomore slump, grow into their better albums and that sort of thing, that magic's going to keep striking. And so it is sad when you see that after that long journey, somebody is moving on.
Yeah, yeah. It's On Second Thought. I'm Leah Fleming. It is Friday, and we are hanging out in the break room. My guests this morning are Stephen Brown, chief film critic of SilverScreenCapture.com, former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr, Greg Williams, mortgage banker and host of the conservative radio podcast called Greg's List, and Anjali Njeti. She's activist and vice president of membership for the National Book Critics Circle. All right, so let us talk a little Facebook. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg testified before Congress for 2 days this week to discuss data privacy and transparency. Here he is answering a question about data collection.
Congressman, in general, we collect data of people who have not signed up for Facebook for security purposes to prevent the kind of scraping that you were just referring to.
There were some awkward moments, but no bombshells. But do you want Facebook to change its privacy rules at all? And if so, how do you want that to happen? Greg, what do you think?
I'm a fan of businesses being able to make their own decisions. I think anybody that has a free Facebook account that didn't realize they were being data mined was naive at best. And I think that Facebook, frankly, should be allowed. You know, Ted Cruz was complaining he was censoring conservative thought. I think that's his right to do so. It's a private company, and I do not like government stretching its tentacles. Facebook doesn't claim to be a news organization. They're a social media site, and I'm very happy to have an account. I did think that Mark Zuckerberg trending on his own creation was probably the most meta thing of the year.
Yeah, Kathy?
I think we've had, 10 hours of testimony before Congress, and I don't think we're any closer to knowing what could be done to protect people's privacy than we were before this whole thing came about. So I think there's some personal responsibility, as Greg said, in that you need to monitor your own information. I don't think many people may have realized that. If they don't now, they need to check the settings on Facebook. But I also think that Facebook needs to do something to monitor its own platform. I don't think you just leave it out there and say, let's have a free-for-all, and then we have what happened, the data mining and possibly Russian interference. So,
yeah. Anjali?
I think it's naive to expect that you utilize a free service, you put all of your data in it, and no one is going to see it except for your Facebook friends. The hearing in some ways was a little bit of a circus to me. On the other hand, I think there are some really important issues with respect to how Facebook handles and monitors hate speech. I see a lot of hate speech on several social media platforms, and the people that I see that keep getting banned or suspended from Facebook are actually writers and social activists who are writing about hate speech. They seem to disappear for days at a time. So I certainly think they need to do a better job with that.
Stephen?
I think we all made an unholy alliance when we signed up for Facebook. We kind of knew what we were getting into. I definitely agree. Free service, you're putting a lot out there. I definitely think the selling the data beyond Facebook was maybe beyond the pale, but it's what we probably signed up for in the small print. But I definitely think the best thing that could come out of it, whether self-policed or enforced, is being able to say where a political ad came from, just like on TV. I think
right.
That's probably smart.
Mm-hmm. Do any of you have plans to get off Facebook?
No, my business is partly dependent on being able to, market what I do, and having a podcast. I mean, it's online. So I absolutely really can't leave. And there's a MeWe thing that was trying to come up. Some conservatives are trying to start their own Facebook. And I think that's silly because I like having a diversity of thought on there. So I never defriend people unless they're just flat out racist or something. And I rarely censor posts. So if somebody gets into an argument and they look like an idiot, I leave it out there so the world can see that they're an idiot.
Yep. It's part of the fun.
I'm not planning to leave, but I don't use it as much as I probably did in the past. I think that if you have a post that's gone wild, I think you can delete it. And that's sort of what I've done. If I've had something where there was things that I put out there that I didn't even realize would cause the
it's
reaction.
So innocuous, you think,
and
right?
I think, oh my gosh. And then, I'll shut it down.
Yeah, people use the platform so differently. And some people are voyeurs, some are prolific content creators.
Right.
And I think just knowing what you are in that is sort of maybe how timid or how open you are to being able to share.
And let's be real. I mean, people have built entire careers through social media platforms like Facebook. I mean, I'm a freelance writer. Probably 90% of the work I get is because I am on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And people with small business owners who otherwise wouldn't have the funds to advertise in print media, they get on social media, and that's how people find out about them.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we're talking a lot about breakups, potential breakups, breakups that are not going to happen. Let's talk about another potential breakup. Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, she made national headlines this week after asking her entire cabinet to resign. And she says that she will decide who gets to stay and who goes by the end of this week. We could hear that today. So what about this? Is this a smart idea? Smart leadership? Bad idea? Is it weird? What do you think?
Talk about draining the swamp, right? But she, was a Mary Norwood supporter. But I got to say, I'm very impressed with the mayor so far. She knows that there's a stigma. There's a cloud of corruption. And I think by doing this and being able to vet, if you read, you know, the article, it has 26 people, I believe. They all turned in their letters of resignation. She said, I'm not going to accept all of them. I gave them 90 days so I could get to know them better. It's her right to come in and build her own administration. So I'm a fan of the mayor.
I applaud the move as well. I think as a PR guy by day, I found it telling that the first person to accept the resignation was the chief of communications. Because it's hard to explain something
funny.
Like
that's
this.
That's pretty funny. That is funny. And but, it's accepted.
But I think it definitely allows you to have a clean slate and to actually make people sort of explain why they want that job. That's not a crazy notion to me.
I think it's a dramatic way to show that she's doing something and, you know, that there is obviously an FBI investigation going on. Mm-hmm. There's corruption that she talked about, the culture of corruption in the previous administration. So she promised to clean it up. So I think that this is the mayors, when they come in, they do clean house. Mm-hmm. And this may be a little more, you know.
Dramatic.
Yes.
And she'd given them the 90-day notice about it, so it wasn't completely right. Unexpected, like via a tweet or something. So definitely.
Not unexpected at all. Exactly. And I mean, look, she has obviously a clear vision for the city, so let's give her a chance to execute that vision. And that will mean very often that you let someone have a fresh start.
Well, the one thing is, she said she was going to do an independent audit, which she has not done. And I think that some people are very upset at that. So I don't know if this will lead to that or if she wanted to, you know, lose some people before that happened.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But they
know.
Are doing the open checkbook. So that's
adding
transparency. And, you know, unlike the past couple of election cycles, you know, the Mary Norwood, that was a very tough campaign and she lost narrowly again. So there was some bitter feelings. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the case of the city of Atlanta, where it should be nonpartisan, I'm going to give the mayor a chance. And I think this is a great first step. And I'm hoping that we see more of this.
Mm-hmm. All right. Sex workers are moving away from social media like Twitter, thanks to SESTA and FOSTA. This is federal legislation that opens websites up to lawsuits from victims of sex trafficking who were taken advantage of via the sites. Even though President Trump only signed that bill Wednesday, certain sites have already shut down parts of their website that involve potentially legal sex work to avoid liability. So should there be a place for sex workers to market their services on the internet, or should that be kept on the dark web? What do you all think about that?
You know, I think sex workers need to be able to protect themselves. I think that's really important. And if they need to find a different platform in order to do so, I'm all for it. I mean, they need to be safe as well. And so, you know, they need to take whatever precautions to keep themselves safe.
I mean, there's still the internet, right? So, I mean, they were probably the only sector that didn't mind Facebook sharing their information. But, you know, there's a you know, I think there's plenty of online advertising available and, you know, it's kind of in people's face. You know, if you go to England or Italy, they actually have just TV channels that are broadcasting and the women are naked on it. So it's a far different society over there. But I remember flipping through the channels and after 10 p.m., be careful because the first three channels, it's boom right there.
It's your child protection
yeah,
remote control.
Yeah, I was about to say, my Comcast remote was really not working that day. You know? Xfinity, triple Xfinity is what we had over there.
Wow. All right. What do you think, Stephen?
I definitely agree with the aforementioned folks. I think it's you know, something everybody needs to be protected, but that's probably a vulnerable place to be out there on the
yeah.
social.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, going from sex to The Simpsons, let's talk about The Simpsons. They finally address criticisms of longtime secondary character Apu, a stereotypical Indian man played by white actor Hank Azaria. Here's Lisa Simpson on the show addressing the audience as she looks at a framed picture of Apu.
It's hard to say. Something that started decades ago and was applauded and inoffensive is now politically incorrect. What can you do?
So for some, the show's reaction was disappointing and even disrespectful. My question, do shows and movies have a responsibility to address offensive content that they have made in the past? And if so, how do they begin to do that effectively? Anjali?
You know, Leah, my father came here from India in 1971, and The Simpsons debuted while I was a teenager. And I have to confess that because of the character, I've actually not watched an entire episode of The Simpsons from beginning to end. It was so embarrassing to me. My father, his entire family have accents, and this, of course, wasn't even really an Indian accent. But I did watch the documentary, and I just think that the producers did such a poor job of handling what was a really important criticism. When there's so few representations of Indians, of South Asians in the media, you know, you can go beyond gross and perverted stereotypes. And it's a poorly developed character. And I think that, you know, if you're trying to write humor, if you can only center it on, you know, racism or, you know, making fun of someone's ethnicity or nationality, probably you need to go beyond that to do better character development.
One of the questions is, do TV shows have a responsibility to address this kind of content? And so I think the good ones will address it. I think culture changes. I think what was acceptable in the 1950s and 60s, how African Americans were treated and portrayed in this country, is not acceptable today, would never be acceptable today. So I think it does change. And I think, unfortunately, what they did was sort of, you know, punt. And someone tweeted, you know, it's not about politics, it's about humanity. And I think that's what the statement that I agree with.
You know, back in college, I went to UGA, the venerable Grady College of Journalism there. And one of my classes, we did script writing. And most of our classmates wrote like a sitcom script for Friends or Frasier was out back then. I picked The Simpsons. And the teacher, the professor, was very skeptical that I'd be able to pull it off. But I wrote a full episode. It was based on Kafka's The Metamorphosis. I had Bart turn into a cockroach. It was actually, they were like astounded with how creative it was. And I did, you know, write in an Apu line. I didn't really use a stereotype. I used him as a pretty funny character about being observant about it. And anyway, it was interesting that, you know, I think a lot of us don't even notice the stereotype. And with your comments earlier, I hadn't even thought about it from that perspective. So.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a whole genre, right? I mean, Steve can probably speak to this too with film, but I mean, the whole sort of white savior, magical native trope, you know, it's very common in all kinds of media, and it's old. I think we need to move past that.
Yeah, I would just say that Hollywood's been pretty terrible on Asian representation. You had recently Scarlett Johansson playing a character that had been Asian in Ghost in the Shell.
Right.
Emma Stone in Aloha playing Native Hawaiian. And some people are getting it right. You know, theater, a lot of the Netflix shows, Master of None and that sort of thing, beginning to tell a more positive story, an inclusive story. And, you know, you've got sitcoms like Blackish and Fresh Off the Boat and that sort of thing, beginning to tell that more wide story.
Yeah.
Simpsons may look a little behind the times on not addressing this.
Well, they had the Mindy Project where the protagonist was Indian descent.
Absolutely.
And I was going to ask you, do you ever critique Bollywood movies?
You know, I do. I actually really love them. I'm a huge musical fan. But there is one that just came out that got a lot of flack that actually had Brie Larson in it. It was definitely one of those white savior movies. And it actually got buried and just released barely on demand last week, and I think they're realizing that you can't do that anymore and get away with it. People will call you out.
It's become a caricature of reality.
Absolutely.
All of this.
Yeah, at the end of the day, The Simpsons, though, it is a satire. They have, Star Wars has even been in trouble in the past where they've had Asian stereotypes with the character, especially from like The Phantom Menace. That was pretty
overt. That opening scene was basically all Asian voices in a very,
the Asian evil trade people, like, oh my God, you know?
We are hanging out in the break room this morning with Stephen Brown, chief film critic of SilverScreenCapture.com, and former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr, Greg Williams, mortgage banker and host of Greg's List. This is a conservative radio podcast. And Anjali Njeti, activist and vice president of membership for the National Book Critics Circle. And I want to ask you all, before we go, about the DeKalb NAACP. They've proposed changes to Stone Mountain to reflect its status as a Confederate monument, but they don't include changes to the mountain, the carving itself. Do you think that changes are sufficient or necessary even at all?
I don't think they should change the carving. I mean, that's like going back and, you know, trying to repaint, retouch the Mona Lisa or something. No, I'm not saying that it's great artwork like the Mona Lisa. Don't try to put me in that corner. But, you know, to go back
send
and
your comments
put in,
too.
to put in a, you know, to put in somebody else or change it. And it's just a bizarre idea to me.
You know, I think what the DeKalb NAACP is doing is putting forth a very reasonable and practical and necessary first step. But I'd like to be incredibly impractical and say that I think something needs to be done to change the monument. Either, you know, add other African-American slave abolitionists next to Davis and Lee and Jackson, or reimagine it and redo it. And I realize, again, you know, the money for that would be incredible. But I don't think we need to have Confederate monuments. And I don't think Stone Mountain, just because it's enormous, should be exempted from that.
Mm. I think it's important to remember that this was not built after the Civil War in the 1860s, that this was built after Brown versus Board of Education in the 1950s started and went on through the 80s. But so it's not a a lot of the Civil War monuments were built much, much later.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think that it's a tough question because the amount of money that
it would cost
is crazy. And also,
all right, Kathy.
I'm sorry, we have to go.
I know, we've got so much to talk about. We'll talk again. That is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our break room panel. You've heard from Stephen Brown, and you've heard from Kathy Lohr, Greg Williams, and Anjali Njeti. And that's our show for today. But as always, we want to hear from you. We talked earlier in the show about whether teachers should be allowed to carry guns at school. So make sure you hit us up on Twitter or Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us today.